This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Well, what's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Today, we are starting a brand new quarterly co-host, and it's going to be a technical one, people. Let's jump into the intro. I'll tell you some more about it.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution or one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding Safety, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by RiskBlue.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. I'm James McPherson from RiskFluent, and I don't have to tell you what RiskFluent is because we've now got the little advert thing at the beginning, so that saves one thing to do. Yeah, you know what I mean? Today is a brand new quarterly co-host. We're doing three episodes on fleet safety, road traffic act safety legislation. It's a weird world. It's a different world. But many safety professionals end up getting it lumped onto them because I think a lot of the time we just think, well, it's just safety, but on the road. But the law is different, the enforcer is different, it's loads of rules. It's quite specific, it's quite, prescriptive. And as we'll find out, it's very technical. But we have a geek when it comes to this stuff, an absolute legend when it comes to this stuff. The one and only Pete Rushmer is going to come on for three episodes, and I'll let him tell you all about what we're going to do over those three episodes in a minute. But if you have taken on fleet, I totally advise you get your pen, you get your paper, and you listen to this guy. But without further ado, let's jump into the episode.
Oh, God, I just press record and now I'm yawning.
Mate, I've already started boring you.
I should have got that out before I pressed it. Literally, I pressed record and it went, boom, have a yawn. Oh, sorry about that. Right.
No worries, mate.
Welcome to the... You actually haven't been on Rebranding Safety before, have you?
No.
Mate, how has that happened?
I don't know. How has that happened?
I'm sure he asked you to come on a podcast before, but I might be wrong.
I think you're wrong. I felt honoured when you did invite me, though. Thank you.
Oh, well, mate.
Only about 6 months after you came on my podcast.
6 months? No, it wasn't. Was it that?
I don't know.
I'm sorry. That's not intentional.
It's fine. It's all good.
We just got really desperate and we're like, oh, fucking hell, we're going to have to talk about like management now, aren't we?
What can we bore our listeners with? Now that we've got them engaged, what can we bore them most with? Let's talk about fleet.
Yeah, we've had loads of feedback that, James, the podcast is way too exciting. Like, I can't concentrate.
Yeah. I know what I'll do. I'll get Pete on.
Mate, that is not true at all. That is not true. God, it took so long. Anyway, now we've introduced you as somebody really boring here to talk about boring concept. You actually want to introduce yourself and you're doing a quarterly co-host, and this is a slightly different one. I'm looking forward to this one. So kind of introduce a concept of the whole thing and then kind of each individual episode, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, perfect, mate. No, I appreciate that. So, hi, listeners of Rebranding Safety. I'm honoured to have been asked by James to join as a quarterly co-host for the next little while. We've got three awesome episodes lined up for listners, just to whet the appetite a little bit. So a little bit about me. So my name's Pete Rushmer. I'm the founder of a business called Flagship Partners, and we do a range of services. We cross over into a bit of health and safety, but our core business is around transport law and fleet operators. We do a lot with operators licenses. We do driver CPC training, which is training that's required for HGV and bus drivers. And we do first aid training. And we've got a range of solutions, but predominantly in the fleet sector. We've even started to build a community called Fleet Geeks. And I'll tell you a bit more about that as we sort of go through. With regards to the next three episodes, today's first episode, we're going to be talking a bit about the different regulations around HGV and fleet management, which is like my specialism, so to speak, or my team's specialism. We've got, put you in the picture, we've got a team of eight people, of which five of them are qualified transport managers in my business. And a lot of them are actually I would say, more experienced than I am, and that they've all got their own different specialisms. So I'll tell you a bit more about them and what's involved. But we'll be looking at that sort of regulatory law around HGVs. We'll be talking about operator licensing. We'll talk about traffic commissioners and people like that, the DVSA and the role they play as well. And then in the second episode, we're going to talk a bit more about transport managers, which is that role of supporting the fleet operation and also sort of the health and safety responsibilities that that role may entail. And in the third one, we're going to have, so I host a Fleet Geeks podcast with a couple of my team here at Flagship, and we're going to do Fleet Geeks Invade in the third episode, which we're really excited about. And we're going to talk about what Fleet Geeks are doing, how they're building a community in the fleet sector, and look what the dent we're trying to make in the industry, and the impact we're trying to have for people with some of the solutions that we're offering, which hopefully will resonate with some of the Rebranding Safety listeners. Does that sound like an okay introduction, James? Have I done all right there, mate?
It's fine, mate. It was beautiful. It was.
Was it?
It was very well polished. Like,
was it
much better than what I do? I feel like you might have rehearsed that. I'd just,
oh, mate, like, it felt like waffle to me.
Oh, what? No. Listen to this podcast. Jeez. I'd just be like, I'm going to talk about fleet and shit. That's about it, really. honestly, I'm so bad. Like, when people get us to do like formal, like, you know, like, hi, James, we love your podcast. We want you to get you to come on to like do a keynote. I'm like, are you sure? Like, I'm not nice. Really good at this stuff at all. That was very nice. Very well polished, mate. I feel like you'd be a radio host.
Oh, really? Do you know what? When I was a kid, I actually wanted to be a TV presenter.
Did you?
Yeah, it's interesting. Genuinely, it's so interesting. I never knew what I wanted to be.
Yeah.
I did. I wanted to be a professional footballer.
Right.
And as you can see, I'm not built to be a professional footballer. I've never been built to be a professional footballer. It was never going to happen. But it's interesting how, I guess, like the journey of life sort of puts you on a journey. And there's been certain, like, really impactful things that have happened that have driven, if you pardon the pun, driven me into sort of what we're doing now, really. And yeah, and it's interesting that I do the podcast and stuff like that, because one of the things I wanted to do TV news, something like that. That would have been great for me. So yeah.
How funny is that? Like, you do loads of like LinkedIn lives, you do the podcast, you got a new podcast, I use this podcast, and I wanted to be a journo. When I was, I did my, what's it called? Work experience at like a local radio station, Connect FM.
Boom.
Yeah.
Bang. Boom. I love that. Mate, I did my work experience at King's College in Cambridge, and I was a chef. Because I thought that I was going to be a celebrity chef.
Mate, this is fucking weird. I was actually a chef. Like,
I'm, really?
There you go. Yeah. So I trained to be, so I wanted to be a journo. I got told I couldn't fucking spell or write shit. And I was like, yeah, you're right. I can't spell and I don't know where an apostrophe goes. So,
was that right with a W or right with an R?
You can't write right. So I was like, okay, fine. I'll do something like, with my hands and shit, and I liked my music, so I ended up wanting to go into like theater. My mate works is a sound engineer, and he still does run his own company, really successful. He's currently on tour with Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Like, he's proper up there, like really hot, well respected, knowledgeable as shit. And so I went to the music, and then I did to train to be an electrician, so that I could go and do lighting in theater. But to finish my electrical qualification, I needed to do a second year on the job, like on the tools, like apprenticeship. It was different back then. And so you did 1 year in college, 1 year on the tools, you were done. And the year that I had on the tools apprenticeship, like less than 10% of our whole year that did that course got on the job tools. Like, nearly all of us didn't get our complete qualifications. So I was like, what the fuck? So I liked cooking as a bit of a hobby. So I ended up getting a job in a pub, local pub, and trained to be a bit of a chef, and then ended up getting a job in a, what I call a ping and ding, which is where you cook food by going beep, 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 bing. And he realized, shit, I don't want to do this for the rest of my life. Is this what chefing is now? Fell into safety is a kind of long and short version of my weird life. But how weird that those two overcross, the kind of journalism slash media slash chefing slash now kind of safety in Fleet and kind of Fleet in safety. I like it.
Yeah. Do you reckon safety professionals came out of all the people who didn't know what they wanted to do, so ended up doing a shit job that they hated, so then ended up in safety? Maybe. Is that kind of how this rolls?
Maybe that. Well, do you know what? There is like a thing where safety professional, nearly everyone says, oh, I kind of fell into safety, because nobody fucking wakes up as a kid and goes, yeah, I want, mum, I want to be a safety professional. Yeah, like, no, I'm right. Disappointed.
Yeah. We're going to take you out and socialise you, you weirdo.
Yeah, let's get people. Okay.
Oh, I love it. So, yeah, man.
Anyway, let's get on to, after your flawless introduction to the concept, let's get on to kind of Fleet management, because it is different, right? I mean, I've only really, actually, until I went into consultancy, have not really dealt with Fleet that much. I've dealt with like a fleet of cars, e.g. we've got like sales team on the road or consultants on the road or engineers on the road and like small vans and shit, but never like HGV. And then first customer that we had for our own customer was within the Fleet sector distribution. And then a couple of subcontracting jobs that we had were HGV. And I was like, oh yeah, this is kind of different, but kind of similar, but kind of different. And it was weird. And there are some really clear legal differences. Well, not clear, but there are legal differences in the fact that like they're drivers. So like, you know, I can get a speeding ban tomorrow if I wanted to. And that hits me. And that kind of still applies in the world of HGV driving as well. So I was like, you know what? This is quite an interesting topic. It's very different. I think there's a lot of people that would listen at Rebranding Safety that do manage Fleet as part of their role or may end up managing Fleet as part of their role. So I thought it'd be a good discussion for us to have. So that's kind of how we ended up here. And then I am mega looking forward to the last episode. Again, no offense to you. I'm really excited about having, I really like when you have like a three-way conversation on the podcast.
It'll actually be a four-way because there's three Fleet geeks and then yourself. So
yes.
But it's going to be fun. It's going to be really good fun. So yeah, I think like road safety is a big passion and I never really knew why. I never really understood why I ended up doing this, but there's a few things that have happened in the past, I guess, that have sort of led me to where I am. And interestingly, as I reflect back on when I was younger, my parents had one of these cars, it's called a Citroen 2CV. I don't know, you're probably quite young to remember a Citroen 2CV.
Even if I was old enough, I don't even enjoy cars.
You wouldn't admit it. So they had this Citroen 2CV, which if listeners are old enough to remember or they want to Google it, they were literally made of cardboard. And my family were sort of trundling along. We lived out sort of Cambridge way and they were traveling in Godmanchester and coming under an underpass in the Citroen 2CV. My mum and dad in the front, me, my sister and older sister and brother in the back. And I was about two. And there was quite a severe incident with another vehicle in the wrong lane. And my mum was pregnant with my younger sister. And my older sister had her teeth, her grown-up adult teeth, knocked out, and my brother had severe sort of back injuries and stuff. And I was actually okay. And I think that kind of affected me. Like, don't crash the car, Daddy, was kind of my thing every time we went out when I was a kid, sort of growing up. Don't crash the car, Daddy. And it wasn't their fault. Huh?
That's fucking traumatic.
I know, right? So I had that, and then there's sort of it's really strange sort of how over time. Like, I was really poorly when I was like 18, and I've probably told the story many times before to people on my podcast, but you know, I'd been in hospital for 6 weeks on a life support machine. I'd been really, really poorly. I'd had like a lung hemorrhage where my lungs had bled. Then they treated me with this drug called Factor 7, which is like a crash victim drug, and it caused blood clotting in my lungs. So I'd had pulmonary embolisms. And the way they treat that is with warfarin, which is rat poison, which thins the blood, right? Yeah. So I'm like 18, trundling along, taking this warfarin, having had a really traumatic experience of nearly dying and being in hospital and all that sort of thing. And a drunk driver was overtaking another vehicle. I actually knew him from school. He was overtaking another vehicle on the straight near my house in Over, just outside Cambridge, where I was sort of, I'd gone back home with my parents to kind of recover. And it was like a Friday night and I'm driving home and he's overtaken a car on my side of the lane and we're about to have a head-on collision and I've had to like divert. He's ended up in the ditch and it was all a bit of a mess. And I was just like, man, I'm like done with this. Like, people, this shouldn't be happening. So I've always had this like massively low tolerance for drink driving, road safety, that kind of thing. And interestingly, when I left the pub trade, I went into working in body repair, right? So I trained up as like a damage assessor. I worked with insurance companies. I understood how the workshop worked. So I kind of had this opening into like workshop mechanics, body repair, paint spraying, all sort of stuff like that as an assessor. And as I developed through that role sort of in my 20s, I ended up in a manager's role and I had to run this HGV. I had to run this truck. And all of a sudden I was having to run 8 vehicles because there was 8 depots and I got sort of thrown in the deep end and I had no understanding what I was doing. If people are listening, I'm sure there'll be people in similar situations. So I wasn't running it wasn't even a fleet of vehicles. I had an HGV which carried vehicles that had been accident damaged into the workshop, and I had what's called a restricted operator's license that I didn't really understand anything about. And I heard about this guy called a traffic commissioner who I'd never heard of, and I was about 25, having just taken on the general manager's role of this business where there's like 30 guys, and the least important thing to me was the running of this truck. Because I had the safety of everyone else. You got the cosh, you know, like paint, you got panel beaters, you've got power tools, you've got hand arm vibration, you know, dust, you know, all of that sort of stuff that I was learning from a safety point of view. And then this like scissor lift truck, which one of my drivers got stopped and they were overweight and they got penalized. And I didn't really understand that either. And then we had to go about weighing vehicles before they got brought in. And I kind of had this baptism of fire, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then the owner of the body shop, he sold up. He sold to a national company who I refused to work for because they're a bunch of pricks. and I went to work for Volvo, who aren't a bunch of pricks. And I went to work for Volvo Trucks.
I'll ask who it was now, but I would not want you to answer.
It's fine. No, I've got no issue because the company went pop anyway. So the other thing is like the ethics are really strong in me as well. And that was the reason I didn't want to work for that national company. They've gone pop now. They don't exist anymore. They're called Nationwide Crash Repairs. And they were heavily involved in what's called an average repair cost model. Right. So this is where your accident damaged vehicle. So we're talking about road safety here, right? Your accident damaged vehicle, you could have had smashed up and you've got, I don't know, like a 15 grand BMW that's got 5 grand worth of damage on the front end, and the accident repair centre are only getting paid 1,200 quid average repair to repair that vehicle that should cost 6 grand to repair. This is still going on, by the way, in the accident repair sector. People just don't know about it. So that was why I left.
I'm confused. So the extent of the damage is like 60K's worth of work, but they're what, making it roadworthy for 12?
Yeah, so basically, yeah. So how average repair cost model works, and it, like I say, this is still prevalent, so check your insurer and check your insurance documentation because people don't realise it. And it's a massive reason I left the business, the industry. So generally speaking, if you've got a vehicle that's 3 years or older, right, the scrap value of that vehicle is probably around 20% of the value of it, right? So let's take a 20 grand car, right? So you've got a fairly decent family saloon, German model, let's say a BMW 5 Series, right? And it's a few years old and it's worth 20 grand, right? The scrap value of that vehicle is probably around 5 grand, 6 grand maybe. It might be a bit different in today's market, which means, generally speaking, an insurer would probably only repair up to about 10 grand, maybe a bit more on that vehicle, because once the estimate comes in to repair it at 10 grand, you've probably got a 10% leeway for fluctuation in parts costs or finding additional damage on that vehicle, right? And obviously the scrap value is that they'll get 5 grand for it if they just sold it for scrap, right? Yeah. So they kind of do this calculation. Anyway, in the background, a lot of these insurers have deals with accident repair centers where they pay an average repair cost. This is called an average repair cost model to drive down the cost of insurance, right? And what that means is if your car has just got a wing mirror scratch or a wing mirror knocked off and it costs 100 or 200 quid to repair it,
yeah,
they're paying 100 quid for it. On those, if it just needs a bumper blowing, that's only worth 100 quid off. More a bumper blowing is probably like 300-400 quid now, probably with the cost of materials. But you get my idea. So they're making margin on that, right?
Right.
However, if that accident damaged vehicle has got 6 grand worth of repairs on it and it needs 4 grand worth of parts and 2 grand worth of labor, for example, that accident repair center will still only get 1200 quid for that repair.
Right.
So what then happens in the workshop or by the management is they lead their team of people. You should get an accident repair specialist in. Anthony Hurd would be a great person for you to speak to, actually, about this. He's a big advocate for it on LinkedIn, if you follow him. Yeah. And basically, yeah, that. So essentially that body repair center is looking at whatever way they can cut corners in repairing that vehicle to put it back on the road, because it's a loss leader.
So like it starts, okay, yeah. I get it now. So like there, you if you're the body repair center, you're basically taking more money, hoping that you never have a big incident car, a big damaged car come through.
Yeah.
And but in theory, you should be putting this money aside for when that big one comes through, but nobody does, right? No one does anything like that.
That's not business. That doesn't make business sense, does it? Business is about making margin, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose you couldn't. If you're going to put the money aside, the model's flawed, isn't it, really? Because if you put the money aside, it would be classed as profit and you get taxed on it a shitload anyway. So your accountant's probably going to turn around and say you need to do something with that money. So you might invest it as something or train your team up or whatever. So, yeah, the model is flawed. But then, like you say, it then encourages the wrong behaviours. So you end up getting cars held together but with duct tape, right? And with you.
Pretty much. So, anyway, I've set the landscape, right? And then I go and work for Volvo and I learn a lot more about HGVs and stuff like that. But anyway, I think I've kind of gone a roundabout way of saying, essentially, HGV and buses, like fleet management, it's like a whole new kettle of fish. So yeah. One of the questions is what's operator licensing? Well, essentially, to be able to operate a vehicle that's over 3.5 tons. So if you... people who are not particularly au fait with vehicles, vans, that kind of thing. If you think of your long wheelbase sprinter that you see the Amazon guys running around in.
Yeah.
They're under 3.5 tons, right?
Right.
So they're largely unregulated. They just operate under what's called, it's called something called GB domestic rules. Okay. Right. And that governs the time that they're allowed to work for, which there's no way of really keeping track of. Because right. There's not a tachograph which monitors time. And so anything that or below for work purposes doesn't fall under operator licensing. Anything that's over 3.5 tons, so bigger than a van, falls under operator licensing. Apart from, it is a bit complex because if you run a combination of van and trailer that's over 3.5 ton, that may fall within operator licensing.
Okay, now, right. Okay.
So if you run a pickup truck that pulls a trailer. So for example, one of our clients, she won't mind me mentioning, she does horse recovery. We don't work with her anymore for various reasons, mainly because we couldn't continue to manage that contract. But she, a lovely lady, she recovers horses who may be on roadside, stuff like that. So she gets called, she has a pickup truck and a trailer, yeah. And she would go and pick those people up for hire or reward. And she needed an operator's license. She actually had to have a taco fitted to the pickup truck for that. Right. It gets quite complex.
And that doesn't fall into LGV.
Yeah. So, well, here's a whole other thing. So LGV, LCV, HGV are all like different acronyms for basic LGV and HGV. It basically is the same thing, large goods vehicle or heavy goods vehicle, basically the same thing.
Oh, really? Oh, right.
Yeah, there's a Fleet Geeks episode where we've literally just done dispelling the acronyms of, because you get PSV and PCV and bus. So passenger carrying vehicle, PCV, is a bus. It's just fucking balmy, mate.
I love shit like that. Yes, I've got a PTV license, fucking bus license. No, it's not. Damn you! It's a PTV license.
Yeah, and then don't even get me into driver's license classification. So, a goods vehicle, on a driving license is category C for a rigid vehicle, or C and E for a vehicle and trailer combination. And then a bus is category D. But interestingly, on a category C, that's classed as a class 2 license, whereas a C and E, where they put a trailer as well, that's a class 1 license, because there's different classes of drivers.
Right. And then within HGV, there's different classes, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And then there's different types of operator's license as well. So
this is kind of why we're doing this, because
it's cool.
An operator license is different from a driver license.
Yes.
Right. So if I wanted to say drive like an eight-wheeler or like an Arctic, the licenses will be different, but I would require operator license to a certain level and a driver's license to a certain level.
The driver's license qualifies you to drive the vehicle, but you don't just get a driver's license. To be able to drive that vehicle, you also have to have a DQC card, a driver qualification card, which is what the EU rules are around driver CPC training, which is what we offer. But let's sort of stick to the simple stuff. Right. So an eight-wheel tipper. So if you think of like a Muckaway eight-wheel tipper that you see, like a dump truck that you grew up with as a kid, right? Yeah. That is, you would need a category C license to drive that vehicle. It's got four axles on it, two of which are driven, the two rear axles are driven and the two front ones are steer. That, generally speaking, is a 32-ton vehicle. So that can operate up to 32-ton. The vehicle itself normally weighs around 12-ton and it will carry about 20 tons worth of payload, generally speaking, give or take a few ton. Obviously, that can never be over 32-ton. If that ever got weighed, the driver would be in trouble and the operator would be in trouble.
Just say that, because that's quite the thing is, if you're driving like an eight-wheeler tipper from, say, like a quarry to the aggregates waste sorting site, whatever, and you overload your bucket or whatever on the back, it takes you over 32 ton, they can get in trouble for that, can't they?
Yeah, they can. Yeah, we'll talk about that. That'll come a bit later. Save me sort of darting around. We'll talk about that in a bit when we talk about the drive stuff. No, that's cool. But it's good to raise that awareness. And then the Arctic, which is like we call them a tractor unit, which has like the fifth wheel on the back that the trailers go on. So you'll see them trunking up and down the motorway, like your DHL trucks, that kind of thing. They're 44 ton. Generally speaking, if they've got a three-axle trailer and a three-axle unit. And you need a Class CE license or a Class 1 license to be able to drive those. What the government did recently with the driver shortage, which people will have heard a lot of uproar about and probably not really understood, was that historically you had to get a Class 2 license, the rigid vehicle. You had to get that license first, and then you'd have to have a second test to be able to do the Class 1 license where you pulled a trailer. The principle behind that is that it's more difficult to pull a trailer. It's slightly more technically advanced. You're looking after two assets. You're heavier, that kind of stuff, right? However, what the government did to make it easier to pass your license, recently as November, they enabled people to go straight to Class 1. So they'd be able to drive that straight away. And what they also did was they took the reversing part, which is the most difficult thing you'll do in an articulated vehicle, is reversing. They took that out as part of the test with the DVSA examiner, and that's now being done privately by the company who do the training.
Okay, that sounds controversial. I am.
It was quite controversial, yes, and it is still quite controversial. Yeah.
Nothing to do with Fleet. I don't know what the fuck you're talking about, but just how you described that, I'm like, that sounds like if I was a Fleet manager, I'd be like, what the fuck?
Yeah. So, and to be honest, so from a Fleet and operations point of view, the risk has massively increased for new drivers recently because you're getting less experienced drivers. Because generally speaking, drivers would get a class two license. They'd go and drive a rigid vehicle for a bit period of time, and then they go and get a class one. Now, you know, I've been out with drivers on driver assessments. So one of the things that we have to do is driver assessments, right? Where we go out a new driver, just because they've got a license and they're qualified to drive a vehicle, it doesn't mean that they're competent to drive a vehicle, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things that you should do, and a lot of Fleets don't do, is an initial driver assessment where someone goes out with a vehicle. And, you know, I've come across new drivers who'll drive a tipper vehicle like it's a car, and it's like, slow down. And you're like, slow down. For those of the people that are listening, I'm like pushing my imaginary brake pedal and literally hanging on for dear fucking life. And fortunately, that vehicle, you know, it roll over, that kind of thing's a real problem. So, I don't know. I've lost my thread. There's so much to share, man. There's so much to share. You don't even realise how much knowledge you have until you start talking about it. Like,
like knowledge. Look at you. You're like, you're surprised at how good you are.
I'm just surprised. Yeah, I'm just surprised. I surprise myself all the time when I tie my shoelaces, all sorts.
You're going to walk out of the room after this podcast. You're like, I am fucking good. Yes.
No laces.
Chelsea. Oh, no, they're downstairs. I also have Chelsea boots just because they're so much easier just to whip on. And I'm always late. Like, I'm always running late. So I'm like, boom, built myself some capacity to fail safe. There you go.
Definitely. Right. I literally live my life 15 minutes behind. Just 15 minutes late for everything.
Yeah. I feel like that's part of running a company now. Like, I never used to be this bad, but now I'm just late for everything. Everything runs over. There's always traffic. Anyway. So I'm still not massively au fait in the operator license thing. So, like, a driver license gets you qualified to drive the vehicle or operate the vehicle. As operator license, does that say that you're competent to deal with the whole part of being a driver? Is that?
Yeah, got you. So drivers don't get an operator license. So they class, and this is interesting because in other industries, the driver's classed as an operator, isn't he?
Yeah.
So from a health and safety point of view, if you're in a safety background, you see the driver as the operator, whether that's on a dump truck that's like off-road on a construction site or whether that's a vehicle, they're the operator. Well, when it comes to Fleet operations, which involve HGVs or buses, the operator is the business that run the vehicle. So they're classed as the operator. So when we talk about operator licensing, we're moving away from the driver licensing and we're moving to the regulation of the business and the activities it undertakes.
Operator
licensing is for vehicles. So companies that operate vehicles over 3.5 ton, although very recently the laws changed where vans that do international work into Europe now fall under operator licensing. So the idea behind this is if you want, you know, rebranding safety, right, we're going to get into haulage. I'm going to buy some vehicles and we're going to go and set up our business where we're going to employ drivers to, I don't know, we're going to do a 32 ton tipper work, right? Let's go with that, right?
Yeah, that's never going to fucking happen. You've said already. Two episodes.
Yeah. So McPherson Muckaway, I like it, right? You're going to start McPherson Muckaway, right?
Okay, I'm interested.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So McPherson Muckaway, what James needs to do to be able to do that is he needs to submit an application to the Office of the Traffic Commissioner for an operator's license, okay? Right. Now, there are three types of operator's license, okay? Number one is a restricted license, okay? So a restricted license is for people who carry their own goods as part of their business, okay? And we work really well with these people, okay? So a restricted operator is someone who a good example is your fruit and veg seller at the market, right? They've got enough fruit and veg for their market, which is heavier than what would be carried in a van. So they need to have maybe a 12 ton small sort of two axle rigid vehicle where they take stuff to and from the market, right?
Right.
I don't know. Let's call this James's Jalapenos, right? So
you should be in marketing. I love it.
James's Jalapenos has works on Wellyborough Market, right? And you've got an operating center. You've got an operating center in Corby, right, where you park your HGV up, right? So what you do is you do an application to the traffic commissioner, where you'd have your operating center, you'd declare your operating center, and you'd send your O-license application in. And to operate a restricted license where you only move your own stuff, it would mean that James's Jalapenos wouldn't be able to carry out, I don't know, Amazon multi-drop for hire and reward separately, because that doesn't meet the operator standards, because right, it only allows you to be able to carry your own stuff. So builders, merchants.
If my mate Pete's potatoes,
he
rang me up and like, dude, my lorry's broke down. Could you bring my potatoes over? I couldn't. Yeah. That was in my license.
No.
Right.
No. Unless you bought the potatoes from him. Right. And they were your potatoes.
Which I would only do at a percentage increase of 40% anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Right. Prices of potatoes are going through the roof, mate. You get the gist of it, right?
Okay,
so right. For a restricted operator, currently, there's no requirement for a competent person or what's called a transport manager, which we're going to talk about in episode 2, which is someone with the transport manager CPC qualification.
Right. Okay.
Now, what you then get is you've got standard national and standard international. Okay. So they're the two other types of licenses, which mean that if you want to carry goods for hire and reward, so, you know, I don't know, DHL, for example, right? They're doing like distribution stuff, that kind of thing. If they're doing that within the UK, they'd be classed as a standard national license. If they wanted to do it within Europe, they'd be elsewhere, they'd be classed as standard international and so forth. So, and to be able to do that, you have to submit your application and you'd have to have what's called a transport manager. If you're a large company, they often have internal transport managers who will be employed. Usually, I would say salaries range from 35 through to like 60, possibly more grand a year, depending on the level of experience, the size of the company. Right. Some bigger companies will have, you know, multiple vehicles across multiple depots. So they'll probably have a head transport manager with a team of transport managers below them. But likewise, James's Jalapenos McPherson Muckaway,
yeah,
if they went for a standard national, you would need to have a transport manager who might be an ETM, an external transport manager. So that's where you employ a freelancer to come in and do that role, because you've maybe only got one or two vehicles and you can't afford 35, 40 grand a year on a full-timer. Mate, I'm boring you already. Look at that yawning. It's actually got to that time. I reckon we're around 45 minutes. Shall I just stop now?
I think
we'll find out about the rest in episode 2. See you later.
In class is about to start, I mean.
Do you want a blanket?
Yeah, I've got my coat here. Look, it's all like inside.
I've
got a blanket here. Look, I can actually.
There you go.
My feet are a bit cold. No, I was just fucking yawning. Why does everyone take yawning so personal? Oh,
I'm not getting all hormonal about you yawning. I couldn't really care. I know I'm interested, and what I'm talking about is right up people's street.
I know that I am fucking awesome. I love that. I love that. Oh, fucking hell.
Okay.
Like, if I'm honest, my brain fucking hurts.
Okay.
This is complex, right? Like,
yeah, fairly. It's so
messy. I kind of like it as well. I'm quite interested. There is like a load of, I want to kind of touch on, we hadn't really planned to touch on this, so we won't spend too long on it. But I do want to touch on this like driver shortage. Like, is there a driver shortage or not? Like, have you got a driver shortage? Like,
Yeah, so there's a thing, right? There's a thing.
How you like look out the window and you're like, do I want to be honest on this? Or
yeah, shall I take the easy answer? Or shall I take the not easy answer?
Or the flagship answer?
I think so. It's interesting. The driver shortage is a little bit. It's a little bit like the fuel crisis.
Right.
It's probably the best way of me trying to explain this.
Okay.
So. The fuel, so is it like the fuel crisis? I don't know. Right. So essentially, for years and years and years and years and years and years, there's been a shortage of drivers, alleged shortage of drivers, right? Because what happens is it's a shit job, largely, it's a shit job that's been underpaid, undervalued, highly regulated, and you know, drivers can earn fairly close to minimum wage or just above it, and they're away working all week a lot of the time, and if they broke the rules they could get fined, they could get points on their license, they could get, you know, their license taken off them. So generally speaking, people viewed it as a fairly shit job that they didn't want to do, and they could probably get work elsewhere for much less risk, personal risk. So that's been bumbling along for a long time. The driver CPC qualification that got brought in 2009 was largely very unpopular, usually because the training was mandatory and was crap. And drivers just got fed up of having to spend 5 days, normally Saturdays, having been away all week, that because it was part of their license, a lot of companies would expect them to turn up in their own time for mandatory training, which they wouldn't get paid for. And oftentimes they actually even had to pay for the training themselves, and the quality therefore was diabolical,
right.
And still to a point is for a lot of people.
Did that made like a race to the bottom then, I assume, like
there's no other industry. So I've got competitors, so we deliver driver CPC training, I've got competitors who are doing it online since COVID, they're able to do it on Zoom. And there's many of them that are doing it for £35 a day. £35 for a driver for a day, which includes, I think they include VAT, and I think they include upload fee of £8.75 to the DVSA. So they are literally making £20 a day per driver, and they're not allowed to train more than 20 in a day. Yeah. And that's if they get all the drivers signed up. Like, there's people out there that will be doing it for like five drivers at £35 a day. I don't even know how they make ends meet. And that has been, so generally speaking, if you were in the sector that we're in, we have to differentiate on quality, which is what we do, which is why we've got our lovely new training centre, and we offer lunches, and we have the very best trainers to be able to deliver to people, because we demand on delivering value. Anyway, that's my little pitch done. I'll shut up now. To be fair, I don't think people buying driver CPC will be listening, so that's cool. So I'm pitching to an empty room. But where was I? What was I bullshitting about? Oh, yeah, I wasn't bullshitting, obviously. But I'm chatting shit about the driver shortage. I think the media like a story, so they cottoned on that there was a shortage of drivers, and which one of the issues was, so COVID caused an issue, Brexit caused an issue, because there were so many Eastern European drivers who then went home during COVID and then weren't going to come back because it was shit. Wages have since, with supply and demand, wages have now increased, and largely speaking, the driver shortage probably only exists for the arsehole companies, because people won't fucking work for them. So you'll hear them talking about a driver shortage, but it's actually because they're arseholes and people don't want to work for them. The good companies have got drivers, generally speaking, because they're good companies and they look after people and that kind of thing. And I think the increase in wages is, I believe, I haven't got the data to back this up, but the evidence is showing that the wages have started to stabilize now. And I think what's happened is that people have found their way back into it because the benefits of them, you know, there's drivers out there now, they've gone from a lot of the time being paid close to minimum wage, and there's drivers now who are, you know, topping out 50, 60 grand a year for driving an HGV, which is good money by anyone's standard and way above the national average wage. But it's not an easy job largely. But I think the thing is that people don't realize is people often fit HGV drivers into one category, but actually there's HGV drivers in every bloody industry. They could be doing waste and recycling. They could be doing skips. They could be doing tippers. They could be doing multi-drop. They could be doing distribution. You know, there's just a myriad of removals, builders, merchants, like literally anything where you've got to move shit, they need drivers, right? So they could be in any type of industry.
Yeah. And I think it was good to kind of maybe double down on the driver for a little bit here, because the thing that fascinates me about fleet management and HGV is the onus on the driver. So like, particularly when a lot of the work I do with clients, and we'll be talking about, it's not no blame. I'm not a fan of no blame. It's more, I don't want to get myself into a fucking rabbit hole here. How do I kind of say this? So essentially I tried to educate and help clients be like, look, our priority is to learn from this incident, for example. So actually it's probably better for us to not have a conversation around accountability right now. Let's save that for another time. Now we're going to have a conversation around how do we learn from this. To do that, I need that operator to be really open and honest with me, and they're not going to do that if they think they're going to get their fucking wrist slapped, right? They're not going to do that. They're going to go into ass covering mode. So psychologically speaking, I kind of describe it as votes. I need to have more votes for learning than I do blame, like that. So we can still have votes for blame, but we need more votes for learning. But in HGV, which is fascinating to me because there's so much of this. I've got one client, like I say, that is working in a large fleet of HGV. And one of the biggest issues is just human error. Like there's so much emphasis on the driver to operate in a really complex, tiring, intense environment for long periods of time, battling boredom or low arousal, as you would kind of say in the human factors world, you know, all of this stuff, dealing with dickheads on the road as well, like all of this stuff you're mega complex on. And we're trying to kind of have conversations around human error and learning and building good relationships with them. But ultimately, there's this kind of shortcut to blame the driver, because legally, the driver has a lot of like legal duties completely separate from the company, right?
Yeah. So here's a great example. Just today, I was having a conversation with a driver who's been driving years and years and years. Good guy, means well, doesn't mean to make a mistake. Diligent, understands the rules around him, right? Just to put people in the picture. I'm not going to name the guy I knew he works for, but I issued an infringement, what's called an infringement letter for him today.
Right.
Okay, which basically warns him, is a warning letter that tells him that on his tachograph, which is what's used to record his working time using the tachograph on the vehicle, last month he had a potential £300 roadside fine, which has to be notified to him as part of the regulations, and he has to sign to say he acknowledges it. And he rung me and said, I don't fucking understand why I've got this infringement letter.
Right.
And when on first look, I thought, actually, do you know what? This is a bit of a tricky one, right? And to put you in the picture, he works Monday, and he has, hold on, let me find, because I drew it out and drew a picture on my phone to show him. So Monday, he starts at 3 a.m, okay?
Right.
3:09, having had a weekly rest. He had what's called a reduced weekly rest, which was 42 and a half hours. When a regular weekly rest is 45 hours. He started at 03:09. He finished at 16:50, 10 to 5 in the evening, having had a duty of around 13 and a half hours. He then had a daily rest of just over 10 hours, okay, which is classed as a reduced daily rest. He then on Tuesday starts at 5.
Would he have been driving from 3 a.m. till 4 p.m? Was that?
Yeah, so a driver, an HGV driver, is only allowed to drive 9 hours in a day, of which he's allowed to increase to 10 hours twice in a weekly period. So that duty period will have made up of driving what's called other work that the tachograph records. So that might be loading and unloading, waiting time, which might be waiting for information or waiting for other people to unload him, and also breaks. So breaks during the day will be included in that duty time. So that's start to finish, okay?
Yep.
So that's a long day, right? Tuesday, he starts at 5 to 3 in the morning and works until 20 past one in the afternoon. Sorry, 4:15 in the afternoon, having had a shift of 13 hours and a bit. And then has a daily rest of almost 10 hours, which is then a reduced rest as well. On Wednesday, he starts just before 2 in the morning and works till 3:30 in the afternoon and has a 13 and a half hour duty. And then he has a 12-hour, 5-minute rest, which he thinks is a long, class as a longer rest. So in his head, he's had a longer rest. And then on the Thursday, he has what's called an infringement because he takes he works another long day and a short rest, thinking that he's allowed one of his three. So the EU driver's hours rules allows, in a working week, drivers should normally have a minimum of, I've got to get my numbers right here, 11 hours rest, and anything less than 11 hours is classed as a reduced rest, down to 9 hours, okay, which they're allowed to do 3 times within a working week. It's very, very complex, and that's why you've got driver CPC training. So HGV drivers are governed by two lots of rules. One's driver's hours rules, which is a European Commission 561/2006, okay, which was updated in August 2020. And then the second set of rules is what's called the Road Transport Working Time Regulations 2005, and these are slightly different because they're for mobile workers who are affected by tachograph. You'll know working time directive, which is where you have to sign out of the 48-hour rule, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, HGV drivers are classed as mobile workers. They can't sign out of the 48-hour average.
Right.
Okay. What that does mean, though, is their duty time might be longer than 48 hours in a week, and often is, but what it doesn't account for is their break period during the day, their POA, which is called a period of availability where they're waiting to work potentially. It gets really complex, mate. It gets really complex.
So your driver that you're talking about there, he's received a fine.
Yeah, a potential fine. So he's got an infringement letter. If he got stopped in the next 28 days by a DVSA officer roadside, he may be issued with a fixed penalty for £300 for that fine.
His hours and the shifts that he do are driven by the company that he's working for.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's an interesting, it's like a joint venture between the driver and the company. So generally speaking, for a minor infringement, that's what he's done there, is classed as a minor infringement. Generally speaking, that would be dealt with roadside. He'd be fined. Likelihood is So it gets really complicated, right? So the operator has what's called an operator compliance risk score, OCRS score, okay? And that is based on, you have two types of encounter roadside with the DVSA. You have what's called a traffic encounter and a vehicle encounter. So you have traffic examiners and vehicle examiners. A vehicle examiner is like a mechanic who will look around the roadworthiness of the vehicle. And you've got a traffic examiner who's the one who understands the driver's hours regulations, and he'll check the tachograph. The traffic examiner is who will fine based on the performance of the tachograph, and the vehicle examiner may fine the driver based on the condition of the vehicle. However, that vehicle is then listed on the operator's license, which then goes back to the business themselves. Now, if there's an adverse encounter, i.e. a driver gets a fine or has broken the rules, there's an impact also on the operator for the compliance risk score. There's like a risk rating or a grading based on that. And then also what's taken into account is MOT failures, for example. So if that HGV goes down through an MOT, the registration number's on an operator's license, that MOT failure will go against the operator. And all operators all companies who operate vehicles will have an OCRS score. They'll have an average MOT pass rate that's monitored. You'll be able to see how their how many vehicles have failed, what they've failed on, and all of those things may trigger a DVSA visit. And then what happens is you've got these different, it's like a traffic light system for the operator based on the DVSA scoring. So you've got grey for new operators who have got no license, had an operator for 2 years or less whilst the data has still been gathering. You then have red, amber and green based on the risk rating or the risk profile of that operator, which is based on the data of previous roadside stops and MOT data and that kind of thing. So, for example, if a vehicle gets stopped roadside, it may be issued with a prohibition. So the prohibition will mean that that vehicle can't be moved or needs to be recovered to a place of repair because, you know, it might have a bald tire or it might have something mechanically unsafe with it. Essentially, the driver could get penalised for that because the driver has checked the vehicle and is therefore signed to say that it's fine to go on the road. But also there'll be a negative impact on the operator, which may trigger a visit from the DVSA. And in severe cases, the operator may get taken to the traffic commissioner. So the traffic commissioner, who sits at the top of the tree, has the DVSA report into them, and they then look after the road safety via both the operator, but also through what's called driver conduct hearings as well. So the driver may be called to a driver conduct hearing. For example, if the driver on a vocational license gets caught using his mobile phone and gets a £200 fine and 6 points, the transport manager for the operator is duly required to report that incident to the traffic commissioner, where the driver may also get called to a driver conduct hearing and may get a 4 week ban from his vocational license. Very interesting there. So yeah, it's just a whole new world, mate. Whole new world for you. So in fact, I did a little bit of prep, right?
You know,
but the traffic commissioner, the thing is I've got to make sure I'm quite precise because other people in the industry, if they listen in, they'll be looking to make sure that I'm precise, right? So the traffic commissioners have what's called statutory documents, okay? I've got numbers 1 to 15 here. There is, if people want to Google or search statutory document number 6 from the traffic commissioners, that talks about vocational driver conduct. It was first issued in 2019, or the most recent edit was 2019, May. But yeah, vocational driver conduct, and therein will lie the conduct expected from vocational drivers.
You're trying to be precise, and I'm asking loads of questions. The one thing that just kind of stuck out in my head there.
Mate, by the way, we've smashed the 45 minutes. Just so.
Yeah, go you.
I'm still on air.
I've completely lost track of time.
It's fine. Don't worry. I think it's probably about an hour.
Okay. So what was I going to say? Right. Driver does something not good, right? Like a minor infringement, and driver gets fined. I'm like oversimplifying this, right? So anyone listening to this who's trying to pull Pete up for saying, well, no, by something I said, then don't be a dick, right? I'm trying to simplify this for my own kind of, the audience for me. So driver, that minor infringement, driver gets fined. That kind of, it's a negative point on the operator license's kind of dial that goes from red to green. In its simplest term, that's potentially.
One incident normally wouldn't potentially change the color of the, but a series of events maybe.
And that's actually my point, right? In that I feel like that could be manipulated in the company's favor, in that you push the drivers to bend the rules a little bit, just get a little minor infringement or you know, hopefully not get caught, because the company is not going to get that much infringement because one or two, you know, on a balance of statistics, it's not really going to affect our dial. So we can push it for a couple of months because we're really busy, because we're in green. Let's just push it for a bit. with the hours or with something else, and the driver is going to get pinged £300. So I feel like the driver kind of gets a short straw here. I don't know. I might be wrong.
Yeah, and that's not... Yeah, so not strictly true. So it depends. There is always a balance between profitability and performance. And the... So potentially the operator, if they lost their license, they'd lose their business and all the drivers will lose their jobs, right?
Yeah.
So there is a balance to be had, and the operator and the transport manager. So the transport manager personally is responsible for that fleet of vehicles, so that he does or she does have a personal responsibility that's part of their undertakings, which is statutory document 3 about the transport manager undertakings. And yeah, so ultimately the risk to the driver is the risk to the operator is still relatively high. They can, you know, if they go to the traffic commissioner, potentially they can have their license revoked. They can have their operation curtailed, so they could lose the number of vehicles. Yeah, there's a lot. The traffic commissioner has a lot of power to be able to punish poor operators, if that makes sense. But yeah, I understand it from a people point of view. It may seem that the driver has got, so the driver's responsibility is to stick to the rules, right? So generally speaking, in my experience, a lot of operators will allow drivers to manage their own time. So sometimes on a minor infringement, it will be a mismanagement of time, a mismanagement of the taco. And actually the operator is expecting deliveries to take place, for example, but they won't necessarily stipulate when. And a lot of the time drivers will be personally incentivized potentially because they want to get home for the weekend, for example. So the more productive they are during, you know, the incentive may be there, the more productive they are during the week, it might improve the time that they get home later on. It may not do. I'm just sort of, I guess I'm just spinning wheels there, really. There's lots of reasons, and oftentimes the rules are very complicated because the drivers have working time and the EU driver's hours rules to contend with. Because it's so complex, a lot of the time the mistakes are just possibly through ignorance.
Yeah. I feel like that relationship between traffic manager and driver is vital. Like,
yeah. Yes.
There's always that balance, but I feel like there's definitely space in there in that relationship to be like, look, you look after your drivers, they'll get the job done and they'll look after you. Like, I feel like they've got that much legal duty on themselves that your job is to just enable them to do their job, because they want to turn up, they want to do their job, they like their job, you pay them well, you look after them, and everything will be fine within reason. But then they're still operating in like an unbelievably complex environment, aren't they? Like the roads themselves are just...
Yeah.
No, it's not those.
Yeah, the human factors element's huge and largely underestimated by operators. If I went into any of my operators that we help and I started talking about human factors, they'd look at me like I've grown another head. Yeah. It's just not a language that's used. But actually, there's probably not an industry that human factors is more affected by.
This is literally kind of fascination around it. It's a, I remember, I'll see if I can find it and I shall send you it. It's fascinating. But there was a psychologist I listened to in a podcast that was talking about flow. So, you know, have you heard of flow? Getting in a state of flow.
Okay. Yeah.
When you're in a state of like peak kind of focus. So you're like really focused on something, you're motivated by it, and you're just in this pure state of flow where you just go in, you know, you imagine like your brain is flowing and everything's kind of working. And you're like, yeah. And then he ended up talking about distraction, right? And he said, if you're distracted from a point of flow, so you're really concentrating on something and something just comes in and completely takes you out of that focused state, which driving is a good example of that, or it can be really focusing on like where you've got to go because it's a new junction or, you know, something really complicated. And you're like, right, I'm going around here, and you're focused on your maneuver and everything's going on. And then all of a sudden some dickhead in, you know, a little Ford Focus just a vroom, straight by, completely distracts you, right? It takes you an average of 20 minutes to get back into that state of flow, according to the scientists, right? And the impact on your temporary IQ is more impactful than you smoking a whole joint of weed and then driving. So you're better off smoking a joint of weed than you are being distracted, statistically and scientifically, you know, theoretically speaking. Obviously, don't smoke a joint and go for a drive. When you get busted, just go, well, at least I'm not being distracted, because you're just to be a dick. But like, I just found that fascinating. And then when I was talking to, like, again, a client of ours who does a lot of work with this stuff and a lot of work with fleet management, and he's trying really hard to build relationships, good relationships with the union, with the drivers. And I just, it's such a challenging environment to deal with. And it's kind of, as you've really beautifully kind of articulated to us, like, it's not really helped by the so complex environment on the legislation side and the regulation side as well. But like, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because it's necessarily needs to be there. I get that. But ultimately it is complex. So you've got complex regulation, complex working environment anyway. And then on the complexity of the road, it's just like, whoa, what the fuck? Like, no wonder people are making errors, right?
Yeah. And in reality, when you look at the accident statistics, it's actually van drivers that are proportionately much more likely to be involved in a fatality. Yeah. But yeah, it's you know, when, so just, I guess just sort of to add on the undertakings for a driver on the operator licensing, the rules on driver's hours and tachographs are observed, and that proper records are kept and are stored, and records are readily available on request by an examiner to ensure vehicles and trailers are not overloaded. So that's a driver's responsibility. I think the issue with the operator is that they may be managing multiple drivers into tens to 50 drivers. So for them to be able to monitor overloading, essentially the operator takes responsibility for training of the drivers. But ultimately, when they're out on the road, it can be very difficult to manage them. You know, they're essentially a remote worker, right? All vehicles operate within speed limits to ensure drivers promptly report any defects that could prevent safe operation of a vehicle or trailer, that defects are reported in writing, and to ensure all vehicles and trailers, including hire vehicles and trailers, are kept in a fit and serviceable condition. So the driver has a lot of responsibility, both for, they have legal duties, both for their timekeeping, but also for the condition of the vehicle and the weight of it as well.
Yeah.
Bosh. Should we talk about accreditations?
You know, yeah. So then in the midst of all of this, we've got something that I know nothing about, and that's FORS. So what the hell is FORS, Pete?
So FORS is a great question. And people will have heard FORS, and they'll have seen those little blue stickers on the side of trucks, which has got like a wheel, and then it's actually the River Thames that runs through it. The squiggly line is the River Thames. So it's created by Transport for London as a stealth tax. No, I'm joking. I'm literally going to be found dead one day. Literally, FORS was founded on a load of brown envelopes.
If you're found dead off like a massive conspiracy that you've just blown up off of my podcast, we are going viral for sure.
Yeah. No, this is, FORS is like, the intention of FORS. So FORS stands for the Fleet Operator Recognition Scheme. Can you hear me, by the way? Because I've just like heard a ping in my ear. You hearing me okay, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, FORS stands for the Fleet Operator Recognition Scheme. And it was started, I believe, by Transport for London. And it was to, they recognised that there were a lot of what we call vulnerable road users around London, i.e. people without these metal cages to keep them safe, where they, if they interacted with a vehicle or a metal cage, that they were likely to come off worse than potentially the driver of the vehicle. So,
like cyclists. So
yeah. So a vulnerable road user is essentially a pedestrian, a cyclist, a motorcyclist.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so that's essentially any type of road user that hasn't got a metal cage protecting them. So what FORS does is FORS can be enforced by what's called work providers. So a good example is the HS2 work that's going on at the moment. They will stipulate that operators running on their scheme need to have FORS, for example, or construction sites in London will say that operators who run into London will need to have FORS certificate. And there's three standards, bronze, silver, or gold. The bronze standard is actually the most rigorous of them all. And you have to have certain risk assessments and policies and procedures to enable you to be FORS bronze. And then silver is like a little step up, which is more focused around the environmental side, things like monitoring fuel consumption and noise pollution and those kinds of things. And then gold is sort of the next step up after that, and normally is involved with what you're doing from a promotional point of view around road safety and those kinds of things and being an exemplary operator. So we help operators become FORS compliant, and there's this standard. It's similar to an ISO, but for fleet operations, basically. It isn't. So what you will find is if you ask one of the traffic commissioners what they think of FORS, they generally have a fairly dim view of it because they see it as a commercial standard rather than an actual legitimate sort of a standard. You know, there have been cases where operators who have just been passed for their FORS standard have gone to a public inquiry with the traffic commissioner and had their license revoked because the traffic commissioner has found that their operations haven't met the standards for operator licensing. So FORS can be a force for good commercially, and if the standards are followed, it will do a business good, but sometimes the auditing standards can be, you know, often the auditors are freelance, and sometimes the auditing standards can vary in quality. So we do FORS, we do support operators with FORS. Generally speaking, it's because they see a commercial benefit from it. My preference longer term, if an operator is thinking about wanting to demonstrate a high standard of operations, I would recommend what's just come out that Flagship are going for approval on, which will be the DVSA earned recognition standard. So that is the standard similar to FORS, but it's been designed by DVSA, the Driver and Vehicle Standards Agency, and earned recognition is very rigorous. And it's an audit standard, again, similar to an ISO, where operators are able to digitally report to the DVSA on both their traffic and their vehicle side around their maintenance procedures, and they can be audited. But additionally, the earned recognition scheme is very rigorous in the way that it tests to make sure that your evidence in the policies and procedures that you've got in place, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it very much tests to ensure that you can evidence and demonstrate the standard that you're demonstrating that you're operating to.
That's interesting.
So you said that. I didn't know whether that was sarcastic or not. That's interesting.
I'm trying to think of a way to. It's kind of like the HSC going, we don't really like ISO, so we're going to kind of make our own ISO because we think ISO is too commercialized. It's kind of what that sounded like.
I don't really know what's behind it or triggered the reason for doing it, but essentially it's kind of what you've just said. So to give you an idea, I talked earlier about the operator compliance risk score, right? Yeah. So you've got this red, amber, green scheme, right? Well, earned recognition operators are what's called blue. Okay. So it's kind of they're like the cut above. and what the DVSA, and the thing is the DVSA a government agency, right? And they've got, like all other government agencies, they've got a finite amount of resources. So they want to make sure that they're getting the best bang for their buck and making sure that they're having the biggest impact on road safety that they can have, right? So if they've got these operators that are blue, that they know are sharing their data readily and their KPI reporting with DVSA via MOT reports, demonstrating that their vehicles are maintained on time, making sure that they've got a proper defect reporting system in place, that they're properly trained drivers, that, you know, they've got a proper infringement process for managing drivers, and they've demonstrated all of that and then been rigorously audited proactively to do it. What's the point in them having a roadside encounter with a blue operator? They're not going to be pulling those operators over. They're going to be able to focus their time on the red operators, the rogues, the people who aren't following road safety.
Right.
Does that make sense? So the idea, in principle, it's a great procedure, and I believe in it, because actually, if the government, if we're going to employ DVSA examiners, they might as well be catching the crims, mightn't they?
Mm.
Yeah. And that's the strategy, if that makes sense. And the reason you have red, amber, green is that if a DVSA examiner is roadside and they're making ad hoc stops, and they've got a choice between stopping a green operator who is demonstrably, by previous history, they're demonstrably better in that they've had more positive roadside stops, they've had a better MOT pass rate, et cetera, when it comes to the AMPR on that number plate, and they've got a red operator, they're more likely to stop the red operator for obvious reasons, because they're more likely to have a problem. And the whole idea is that it's kind of this ecosystem of trying to keep the roads as safe as possible and make sure that only, you know, operators are running legitimately and drivers are following the rules and those kinds of things.
Yeah. Hmm. That is quite interesting, actually. I know that sounds like I'm being sarcastic. I'm not.
It does, doesn't it? I hope people have found it interesting, a bit of an insight into how these things run.
Yeah, like
how it works.
I knew it was complex, but shit, like that's really complex. And then when you add on that interesting little bit there you said about like fours, and I think we experienced that with 18,001, and I think that's a part of an attempt of what 45 is trying to do, but not sure if it's going to work, in that it's become commercialized and it's become a badge and it's lost its meaning, in that to your point, like you said, with fours, you get a good auditing, a good accrediting company, and you get a company that wants not just the badge, but also they believe in the intent of the badge, and they kind of implement 45,001 in its spirit, and not just, you know, they follow it to it the spirit of the accreditation and not the letter of the accreditation, then essentially it's a force for good. If you just do it to get the badge, it's kind of a force for nothing or essentially a force for bad, to mislead. So yeah, I find that interesting that fours kind of seems to have that same battle, in that it can be done right.
I've got to be conscious to give an impartial view on things, because I've got operators who pay us good money and they pay good money to be members of Fours. And I think if I'm being really, really fair on my critique of it, it is that if, like you say, and it's almost very similar to the ISO thing, and that is, if operators are going to use it and they're going to implement it in their business and they want to do it in the spirit of the way it should be done, it will make a good impact on their business. Mm. And if they win business that they wouldn't have won off the back of it, that's a positive thing for everyone involved, both commercially and from a fleet safety point of view. And we have gone into operators who, you know, as part of doing the Fours operation, we will look at their operator compliance and we'll bring the both up as a standard. So that's a great investment of their money. It's a great investment of their time. And also the benefit of Fours, there are many benefits to Fours, and I think I'm probably a bit unfair on it, around the requirement to train drivers. Yeah. You know, so one of the things for Fours Silver is drivers have to do what's called a safe urban driving course. And that's where drivers, as part of their driver CPC, they'll spend half a day out on a bike and experience what it's like to be on a bike, which a lot of them may not have done, yeah? So that's a mandatory course for Fours Silver. In principle, that is not a bad a bad thing at all, right? So there are elements of it, and there's so many, you know, we talk about cycle safety for fours, we talk about vulnerable road users, we talk about even like security and anti-terrorism. So things like, you know, things that were never, Force started talking about things were never talked about, like vehicles being used for terrorism, right? So having control of the keys at all times for the driver. Drivers wouldn't have thought about that. They'd leave the vehicle idling whilst they made a delivery, and someone could jump in and go and use that vehicle to go and smash up a load of innocent people. Yeah. So, you know, I get frustrated when sometimes standards are used for purely the commercial element and the safety message gets lost in translation. And I think that's probably how I came across, and I'm probably starting to maybe regret it a little bit. But, you know, I've not said anything that I want to retract, because...
I don't think it comes across like that, Pete, at all. I think it's so similar to a lot of stuff in safety, and I think you're probably a lot more balanced in the way that you describe it as the way I describe it for my side of things. But it's kind of very similar to like the professional membership discussion that we had, in that, you know, it's there for a good reason to have like a badge, whether it's for a company or a professional or whatever, and it's got its right intent, but the manner in which we've used it has meant that it's lost its meaning. So really it's like, and fours is probably early doors, so it hasn't really lost its meaning yet, but if we continue to misuse it, you know, everything created is created for the intent of good most of the time.
Yeah.
And people use it for the wrong reasons, and it devalues it. The internet is a beautiful thing, but there's some people do some right nefarious shit on there. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it is what it is. So yeah, no, I don't think you came across like that.
Definitely. Okay, cool.
Right, mate.
Mate, I think we'll aboard listeners. Like, there is a crash course of literally operator's licensing.
Yeah, my bum hurts, so I know that means that it's time to stop.
My bladder's starting to burst.
Yeah. Oh, mate, that was a baptism of fire into the complicated world of fleet management. I have a grown respect for you today that was already there, but it has grown bigger today. Your wealth of knowledge on that was impressive. So thank you very much for enlightening us on that, Pete.
You're welcome.
Obviously, you know what you're talking about. So if somebody listened to this and been like, fuck me, I need to talk to someone who knows what they're talking about and fleet management, obviously you're the place to go. So how do they do that, mate?
Yeah. So obviously people could talk to me or obviously one of the very experienced team that we employ. My business is Flagship Partners. And we can help people from grey company car fleet, because we've not really talked about company car fleets and vans today. There hasn't been time, but those risks still exist. Whilst they may not be operator licensed, the risks still exist, making sure that drivers don't drive tired, making sure that vehicles are safe for the roads and vehicles are properly serviced and maintained and have their MOT and all that sort of stuff. So we can help people with all that sort of traffic management type stuff. We help with public inquiries, we help with operator license applications, we help new transport managers, because one of the things that we will touch on later on is that transport managers who are newly qualified and pass their exams, it's a bit like health and safety. Just because you've got the badge, it doesn't mean that you're competent to do the job. Yeah. So we, you know, Fleet Geeks as a community of transport and fleet managers. So have a look at the group on Fleet Geeks on Facebook. We've got a group there, which is free. You can join the community. We're setting up a peer-to-peer mentoring group, if that's of interest for people, where they get to meet other transport managers from different industries and find that best practice and that kind of thing. Flagship Partners. Yeah, we're home for training, for consultation. You know, we do safety type stuff, but a lot of our stuff is really geared towards this industry that me and all the team, we've sort of grown up in and understand.
Awesome. Love that. We shall put websites and all of the links.
Yeah. That. And we've got the podcast too, Fleet Geeks podcast. And my podcast is Half Dozen Things, where James has been a guest.
Yes. Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
Which is my longest podcast to date, actually.
Woo!
Because James wasn't boring like I've been.
No, because James can waffle shit for a long time.
Yeah. How's it been, actually, having to stay quiet whilst I've just waffled on?
Painful.
Has it? Sorry,
I'm like, fuck, I've got to do two more episodes with this guy, and one of them's got three of them coming on. Like, I'm just not going to talk.
Oh, mate, you need to try and shut Mike up is going to be your problem. Mike's our transport manager, CPC trainer, that's used to having guys for like 2 weeks at a time. Mike, if you're listening, shout out to Andy Dunn. Andy, if you're listening, I really appreciate your help. He, very short notice, just made sure that I prepped to make sure I'd got the dates for the different regulations and stuff like that. The shit I focus on, the shit I need to know, right? Because there's so much to know. I don't need to know what date a certain regulation come in. I just need to know what's in it. Does that make sense? So obviously I needed to be precise in the information I gave, and he just made sure that I had that data readily available. So Andy, big shout out to you. He's one of our driver assessors and trainers. He's a data guy. He's very capable. So yeah, thanks, Andy.
We all need an Andy Dunn in our lives.
A lot of fleet operators need an Andy Dunn. If you want a driver assessor, he's your man.
Yeah, Andy Dunn. Here he is. Yeah. He's listening to this. He's like, God, stop saying my name. Andy Dunn.
Andy Dunn.
Andy Dunn.
Andy Dunn.
My mate, I enjoyed that. That was entertaining. It was educational. It was mind-blowing. It was everything we asked for in a podcast. Thank you very much.
I hope people have got some value from it. Cheers.
I will, mate.
Okay, peeps, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Pete. I told you it was technical. This guy knows his shit. And then we're going to go over to episode 2 next month, so make sure you come back for that with your pen and pad. And then, like Pete said, in episode 3, we're going to have 3 of them bringing over the fleet geeks, and we're going to chill out a bit more and kind of find out the pros and cons of the industry, the gripes and the groans, and really get into it. And you know, if we could do it face to face, still trying to work out whether we could do that, but if we could do it face to face, if we can do it face to face, it'd be kind of like just having a couple of beers and chewing the fat about road traffic and safety and shit. Catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.